Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
June 2nd, 2019, and welcome to episode 193 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and uncollecting. So, with me today, we have three other roundtablers. First on my list here, to my left, is Carrington Manston in Toronto. How are you?
Am I to your left? I guess slightly to your left.
He is to my left. I assert that he is to my left in my visual picture of this.
I guess
this.
It depends on how you rotate. So sure, I'm to the left, and I'm doing well.
Excellent. All right. And in my mind's rendition of this virtual table, to Carrington's left is Jack Nutting in Stockholm. How are you, Jack?
Hello, Paul. I'm doing well.
That's perfect.
So does that mean that I'm straight across from you then?
I think so, yes.
And suspended above
Carrington's
us.
Carrington's to your left, and I'm to his left.
It's very easy to see on the globe.
yeah.
And then to Jack's left is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm going to have to question these seating arrangements, though.
It's like a little traveling salesman problem.
I'm just happy to be at the adult table.
And I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston on Earl's left. So there you go. Now you know how the sausage is made.
Better than most Infocom maps I've been playing recently, so I'll take it.
North, south, wait.
If I go to the left, can I then go back to the right?
Yeah, but you won't end up where you started.
Oh, that's right. Man. Yeah,
there you have to go southeast and down.
Twisty little podcasts all alike.
All right. So anyway, so here we are. For those of you following along in real time, just hours ago, the previous podcast got released. So I don't know. Anyway, maybe this one will come out faster and it'll be like two podcasts at once. But so I am tasked with the host's topic, being the host. And I think what we'll do is talk about, I'm on the fly figuring, just choosing the host topic as we go. You see how much preparation goes into this. Some time ago, Yorma sent an idea for a topic about how to go about sort of cutting down on a collection if you needed to. So imagine you're moving or something like that. How would you go about doing that? How would you narrow down by brand, by type, by form factor? You know, would you become a calculator collector?
Ooh.
How would you do this? I guess you have to imagine your own constraints. Like, how small are we talking? I don't know. Does anyone have a place they wanted to start with this?
I think the last I mentioned, form factor, is probably the best. Like, I could think, yeah, brand, great. But like, you know, imagine I wound up with some like weird gigantic wire wrap prototype of some Atari thing that took up half of a rack. And it's like, no, I don't really have room for that. Even if I wanted to pare down just Atari stuff, I'd still be like, nah, that's not really a thing that I'm going to have a way to display or use in any way that makes sense. So like, I think format, I think going for smaller stuff, and I don't have a big collection as it is, but like, even as much as it is, I tend to, if I have a choice, I will go for the smaller thing in general.
As opposed to just, I only collect mainframes.
Well, I suppose you could be moving to a warehouse.
Hmm.
But
after your divorce,
not exactly in the spirit of the question, I suppose, but
I think a lot of people collect by brand, in that a lot of retro collectors are doing so because of nostalgia, and most of us have like a particular type of computer. Like I like old Apple stuff, so I tend toward those. Whereas like Atari people might just want to collect Atari 8-bits or something. Although a lot of people with large collections do end up seeming to branch out into a bunch of things. And yet they'll stay like kind of still in their wheelhouse. Like somebody in North America will probably collect vintage computers from North America, versus somebody who's collecting, say, just prototypes or knockoffs or something, who just has all Russian computers or something. Hmm. What about you, Paul? Like, is there any rhyme or reason? Amount, like, you've got quite a sizable collection. Has that been focused on anything? Or if you had to cut it down, how would you focus? That's the question, though. If you had to cut it down, what would you do? If you were forced to start cutting down today and be down to less than 10% of your collection, how would you whittle it down?
It is a good question. So there's a couple different ways that one could go. I mean, like, if you just had a bunch of normal machines, you know, a TRS-80 and an Apple II and a Commodore and stuff, then you could just sort of like pick whichever platform you wanted and kind of stick with that. But I was thinking about it a little bit, the fact that, so I have nostalgia primarily for the Apple also, but, and so I would probably want to keep at least some Apple II form machine, probably a 2E. But then I was thinking, you know, all of these things are pretty emulatable. So if you really wanted to keep, like, the interesting thing, it is the prototypes. It is the, you know, the machine that was somebody's, you know, that somebody famous owned this machine in the past, or this is a thing that there are only, you know, 200 of in the world. You know, so keep that.
Certainly, that could be a criterion. Hang on to the stuff that is most likely to actually retain some value. If you hang on to a 2E, it essentially will value out to nothing after X number of years. But if you have a one-of-a-kind item or a prototype item or a signed item, you could say, I'm just going to hang on to those, like things that might actually have some value in 20 years, like collect from a value standpoint.
Yeah, or even, I mean, I guess...
Or rarity.
One question, too, is, I hate to even ask it, but I mean, like, what really is the difference in your experience between typing on an Apple II and, you know, or maybe more, like playing a game on an Apple II and playing a game on an emulated Apple II. If you can get a joystick, then, you know, it's not different.
Well, I know for me personally, like and it's in the notes, but we haven't talked about it yet. I've been struggling for ages because I'm a full on minimalist. Like, there's that Marie Kondo or whatever says, only keep the stuff that sparks joy. And like, nothing brings me joy. I want to get rid of all of it. So I'm just like, I am happy when I drop ballast. Like, the less stuff I have, always I'm happier. I'm always looking around my place.
This
thinking,
Marie Kondo book does not spark joy.
No, the book has got to go. Marie, get out of my house. Like, just, I'm always looking to minimize. I'm just happier in empty spaces. I'm just want to live in a van down by the river. Like, less is better for me in all ways. So I struggle with having a collection because I do still like things, and I like the form factors, and I like vintage computers. So I end up like bubbling up to having a collection. I've right now got two Rubbermaid bins of Apple II software. I don't even know why. I'll probably next time at Kansas Fest just bring them and say, here, just get these out of my face. And I had a few computers and finally narrowed it down after getting rid of the Atari 800 I had for a while, narrowed it down to three Apple IIs because I want an Apple II. So I have a 2GS, a 2C, and a 2E. And for like a year and a half, I haven't been able to decide which one is the one that I want. There's pros and cons to all of them. I have more nostalgia for some than the others, but I like the smallness of others. And the GS has the best keyboard, but the least kind of nostalgia for me. It's kind of like just. And finally, I've decided, you know what would make me happy? If I didn't have any of these stupid things, because I mostly use them in emulation. So I have decided to actually go all emulator and narrow down my collection by getting rid of 100% of it and to narrow down to the invisible. The only thing I've been using my Apple IIe for, like when I use it most often is for playing Infocom games, because I really like the pitch dark thing. So it's been fun to play those on an actual Apple II, but I don't actually enjoy that more than playing them in an Apple II emulator. I still like to play the Apple II versions, but I kind of enjoy the convenience of emulated things. So I can see me picking up another computer like in the future, like adding a retro computer, and it might be even an older one or something that's more difficult to emulate. But the really old stuff, like the Apple IIs, the emulators are so good for these that I don't feel like I'm missing out on too much. We'll see. We'll see if I change my mind. But I've decided to get rid of all of it. So that's how I'm narrowing down mine. Open the door, out it goes.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I use emulation most of the time too. And the main thing I used to use an actual Apple II for was doing disk imaging, you know, so I would turn it on and use my EDD card to, you know, make nice disk mm-hmm. images of the original floppies. And the problem is, you know, or not problem, the fact of the current time is that now there's this applesauce thing. It's a USB thing that you plug into your modern machine, your Mac, and the Apple II it's not involved at all. You know, it's the disk drive from the Apple II, but that's it. So I don't know when the last time is I've actually turned on a 2E. I think I probably turned it on just to show someone in my office, look, it turns on. What about you, Earl?
Well, I'm actually kind of in this situation currently that for both space and clutter and time, I need to downsize. And so I've actually faced this problem head on. I'm inclined to mostly narrow down by brand. And part of the reason is the machines that I do have in my collection, I want to be able to not just have the machine, but also have some spares of the machine in case it blows up, and also have some of the cool peripherals that are coming out these days, you know, all the new cool add-ons. And I find that you can oftentimes share these cool toys among different computers that are of the same manufacturer. So for instance, of course, my thing would be Commodore. And if I had a VIC-20 or a Commodore 64 or a Plus 4 or a 128, among any of those, I would be able to share some of the solutions like the disk drive emulators, like an SD card based disk drive storage solution. It's the same port, whether you're talking about VIC-20 on up, not including the Amiga, but all the 8-bit stuff. And there's a certain amount of knowledge that gets shared among all of these computers too. Like if you're loading a program on a PET, you're going to load it using essentially the same command that you're going to use if you load a program on a Commodore 128. You know, all the way through the line, there's a certain amount of commonality. So it seems to me like if I narrowed down by, say, form factor, and I just had a bunch of small machines, but they'd all be different small machines. I'd have, you know, a TI CC40 over here and, you know, some sort of a Sharp little pocket computer over there. I wouldn't have much, if anything, to do with each other at all. I couldn't share any aftermarket stuff. I wouldn't be able to share any knowledge. So kind of picking a brand and sticking with it, it's not just like back in the old 8-bit war days. I mean, there's actually some pragmatism associated with it now.
Pragmatism? I'm out.
This does not bring me joy. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the counter argument is that it's, you know, if you have a bunch of the same thing, then there's only one thing you can do, right?
Well, that's true. I love all of it, which is why, to a certain extent, I've got a bunch of all of it, but I just don't have room for all that anymore. And certainly, I can't buy all the cool third-party toys that are out for all of these things. You know, I can't buy that. Like, if you look at the Atari 8-bit stuff, if you listen to the Antic podcast, oh my gosh, the fun add-ons and enhancement boards and things that are out for the Atari world now, it's incredible. There's a lot of fun to be had there, but there's also a lot of money to be spent. And if you're doing that for Atari and Apple and Commodore and Sinclair and this and that, you'll go broke and you will at some point get crushed by your collection. It will happen. Maybe even literally.
And that's the thing with my 2E, which has kind of been my main driver computer when I use it. Like it's fairly tricked out with a CC whatever they are card that gives me the hard drive thing and a VGA card and like a bunch of stuff in it. So there's a chance I'd want to hang on to those cards, but I really hate hanging on to stuff just for like a just in case later thing. I think I'll most likely, you know, say, hey, anybody in Toronto want vintage computers? Cause I got a few to give away. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, who knows? I guess if this time comes, we are not prepared. But it's worth thinking about. I mean, someday you might need to move.
So. Or to minimize, like we've talked previously about like a next stage. Like eventually, probably all of you are going to die. Like I'm hanging on here, but like everyone else eventually is going to go. And, you know, you have to deal with like what is your going to happen to your collection afterwards. And in a sense, like you want taken care of and go to people in the community, but you also want to limit the burden you're leaving for other people to deal with this stuff. So you might be forced to narrow down your collection yourself at some point, thinking, well, I'm doing this so that it's, you know, when other people take it over, it'll be already somewhat sorted for them.
Right. And there's also just kind of the realistic, somewhat in the same vein, you know, realism of the fact that, you know, there's probably more things in my office than I will have time while I'm alive to deal with, you know, at least in any satisfying way. So, you know, it's quite possible that making a sort of prioritized list of what you'd like to do can help with this as well. You know, the stuff at the bottom, if you're not going to have time to get to it, might as well give it to somebody who has it higher on their list.
And you got to think about which order you get. Is your collection a stack or a queue? Like when you add things in, which is the order you're taking things back off, if at all? A lot of people with collections, physical they pile. Add things yeah, more quickly the than they use things. Yeah, okay. So it's a pile. Yeah. I call it a stack.
That's what I kind of meant by the time. And also there's a certain, I don't know if I want to call it a stress factor, but there's a kind of a feeling of lost opportunity when I have things in my collection that, you know, I look at them and it's like, man, I'd love to have time to do something with that, but I know I'm just never going to have time for it. So then, you know, it actually kind of feels more bad than good at that point. Like, wow, what a shame that I'm never going to be able to play with that. So I'd rather, like you're saying, Paul, I'd rather give it to somebody who's actually going to do something with it. And, you know, then who knows, maybe they'll blog about it or, you know, post some pictures of some fun and it's just more fun for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely it's stress-inducing to have all this stuff. I think probably even if there was nothing else going on but going through that stuff, it would be stress-inducing. Because whatever you're working on leaves all the other things not being worked on.
Right.
Mm. And cared for and whatever, or backed up or dusted or just used.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or repair is another thing, too. I go by brand because sometimes they share some of the chips. At a minimum, they share some of the concept of operations and knowledge, you know, going from one to another. And, you know, again, from the repair, these things are all going to break. We've talked about, you know, recapping and replacing chips and all that kind of thing. Man, if you're doing that with four or five different brands of computers, it's just yet another way to go broke. Whereas...
But do you need to hang on to a ton of spares in your, like... possession, like so you've got a closet full of parts machines just in case one day you got to recap something. Those machines will all be available on eBay 4 years from now when you need one.
That's true. Although if you came across them pretty easy, like for instance, the Commodore 128, that's my favorite. That's like the centerpiece of my collection. So I've got three backup 128s. Now, is that excessive? You know, probably, but I got them for free. They're here in my collection. If I get rid of them and later have to buy it, you know, then okay, you know, at least I didn't have to take up that space for that amount of time. But by the same token, then I got to buy it later, which is a pain in the neck.
Have you considered consolidating all your Commodore 128s into one Commodore 384?
Like just for Commodore 512. Yeah, no, I thought about it. It'd be awesome. And I could sell it for a lot of money, previously unreleased. It's a prototype.
Well, perhaps if we can figure out the algorithm, you can marshal all of your computers to mine a Bitcoin.
I doubt that they could mine even one Bitcoin in their entire life. But
I wonder at what point there'll be enough people at Kansas Fest that if they pooled all the resources, you could mine one Bitcoin during Kansas Fest. Like, what would be the number of attendees and retro Apple IIs you'd require to actually get that done within the duration of Kansas Fest?
You realize, of course, if this is computed, it's going to wind up being like 15 million or something.
Oh, sure, yeah. But then that gives you guys a target. You're on the Cannes Fest committee.
Right.
Figure it out.
Actually, I think the irony will be it will always be one more Apple II than what you have.
Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts on the downsizing topic? This could be probably the topic for the next few, actually.
Yeah, it's a good topic, and a lot of people are dealing with it. And conversely, it seems like you've got more people entering the hobby and getting interested in it. So, you know, it's a good, like, time to consider the redistribution, because for a lot of these machines, at least at the moment, eBay prices are crazy. And that's, I wish it wasn't the case, but like Carrington says, you know, the prices of these things are going to go up, 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 boom. Then they're just going to drop as the people who are actually interested in this goes to zero.
Die.
Yeah, at some point in the future. So,
stop beating around the bush there. We know what's happening with people that are interested in this. Yeah. But that's been the case with a lot of things. There was some collectible plate or doll or something that was like one of the first big things post-World War II that did that. They were massively, massively collectible and hugely expensive. And then in a very short period, just like immediately worth nothing because nobody wanted the stupid things anymore. And I suspect most collections go through that same sort of rise and fall. And so be it. But at the same time, like, I'm looking forward to not that many years from now. I'm now at 50, which is a crazily high number. Who thought I'd live that long? And so I'm not that far from ideally eventually just being retired. And then hopefully that means my life is filled with more vintage computer stuff and time rather than less. So things like, as the people who are interested in this might eventually have a bunch of extra free time. And maybe the industry or the hobby rather will benefit from that.
And not to wax too philosophical, but I think I do find it kind of interesting that, like, there's other things that people collect, like stamps or coins or pocket watches, you know, vintage timepieces, books. And those things wax and wane through time, but, you know, but they tend to still be kind of persistent. You know, like, I think probably 300 years from now, people will still be interested in vintage timepieces. But these vintage computers seems different. It does seem like this particular hobby has a shelf life. And once that shelf life is over, I just don't see hordes of people collecting and playing with vintage computers. It'll just, you know, that'll be it. It'll be over.
One guy.
Yeah.
With all the computers. It'll be Paul.
Yeah.
Also, I just looked it up and it turns up I'm actually 51. I'm so old, I don't know how old I am.
That's cool.
Numbers don't go as high as my age. That's hilarious. I started thinking, am I? How old actually am I? Doing the math. I had to look it up on a calendar.
Well, for decades, I've had to do math to figure out how old I am.
Yeah.
I like to answer in months these days because it really freaks people out. It's like, well, how old are you? Well, you know, I'm like...
I'm in my first millennium.
I'm 673 months. How about you?
This many, and you know, like, flash your hands
for many, many times.
15 minutes.
That would be a very long jazz hands routine if I did it. Flash, flash, flash. I don't know. What's Carrington doing? I don't know. I asked him how old he was, and he started doing this seizure. I don't know what's happening.
All right.
Last I saw him, he was frantically waving in the distance.
Get us back on the road, Paul. We're
yes. Okay.
Yeah, Paul, so, you're the host. Control this show.
On to listener feedback. Not very much this time, actually. I'm going to mention just a couple. So Joachim wrote an email saying, since you're speculating about Fujiyama 2019, later I'll mention it as part of the show roundups, but it's in Langenfeld, Germany, at the end of August, beginning of September. And it's like a Atari thing. But we were sort of, we've probably mentioned it, you know, in each of the last like three or four shows. And, you know, it's kind of an Atari event. It seems like it's a week-long thing. It echoes with Kansas Fest, and none of us had heard of it before. But Joachim wrote to say, 2019 is actually the 20th incarnation of the meeting. So that's a long time over
which
we hadn't heard of it. He says, yeah. Usually it's only 4 days, but in celebration of its 20th anniversary, it has been extended. So, and Kevin Savitz has announced he will attend.
Yeah, Kevin told me he's going to go for the whole week. Cool. And I'm thinking about going probably just like a weekend. Like, I'm not going to do a whole week thing, but I don't know. I think it ends on a Sunday. Maybe I'll go down on Friday or something. I don't know.
But that's pretty cool that it's been going for so long.
It's interesting because it doesn't really, like, it's just a posting on the Atari Age forum. There's not like a web page for this event where they give information about here's what to think about, you know, like, so I have no idea. I've seen photos of people in tents and with campers. Like, is that it? Do I have to bring a tent? May I sleep indoors? Are there toilets? I don't know. There's so many questions, but I'm thinking about going. I'm likely to
also,
go.
Also, there's no power, so everyone has to hand assemble all the 6502 code. Anyway, well, report back. Certainly, if you go.
I will, of course.
Okay, let's see. So, Ben on Facebook had a link to something. I don't think we talked about this before. I think the link was a little bit old. The actual posting is from March 2017. But it's called The Mysterious and Strange Origin of the Floppy Disk. And I thought this was kind of cool. So I think maybe I'll insert this as if it were a news item of mine. But anyway, it's basically just somebody looking into the history of floppy disks and how it came to be. And apparently there's at least a connection to this weird, eccentric Japanese inventor named Yoshiro Nakamatsu, also known as Dr. Nakamatsu, who I guess holds the patents for the floppy disk and the protective envelopes for floppy disks and head cleaning floppy disks.
Or he may be insane, or both.
Right. Yes.
I read this article and I was like, what? This guy's awesome.
He's really quite something. I mean, reading the list of the other things he invented are also pretty amusing. The Pion Pion jumping shoes, the NRX system for generating hydrogen and oxygen intended to be used as a car engine that runs on tap water. Anyway, whatever.
He's not an inventor so much as he has a lot of patents.
Yeah.
So patents don't mean that thing exists. I mean, he jots down and says, here's what would work. You'd have this machine and you'd put tap water in and you would drive forever. And bingo, I've invented a car that runs on tap water. That's not really like what inventing is, but okay. Also, he's got his 24-karat gold bathroom that's made without any nails for some reason. And he calls it his calm room. And he likes to sit in there. He also, what's this thing where he deprives himself of oxygen? So he likes to make his inventions half a second before death. And so I guess where his best ideas come from. And he refuses to call the elevator in his house an elevator because he says it's actually a vertically moving room. Like, the guy is crazy. Yeah. But my favorite invention is his latest one, which is the guard wig. And so he's invented it ideally to give to Donald Trump because it's a wig with a sword and a shuriken built inside it that you can pull off and throw at people to protect yourself. It's amazing.
Yeah.
This guy is so crazy and so fun and so weird. I can't help but love this guy, even though I'm pretty sure IBM invented the floppy disk, not this guy, but whatever.
Right.
I like it. I like his version better.
Yeah, there's part of the article does say that IBM claims that a team of engineers led by Alan Shugart invented the floppy disk in the late 60s. And there's a little bit of a story behind that. And like, you know, what was actually going on there. Nakamatsu claims that he licensed the floppy disk patents to IBM.
But he did that IBM's 10 years right after they invented them. So, but it could be like he could still have had a patent for it in Japan. And then IBM went to use floppy disks in Japan and said, oh, this guy's got a patent on this stuff. Maybe it's cheaper if we chuck him $1,000 and license his patent rather than get in a prolonged legal case about this. Like, so who knows what the real background is? But regardless, the article is hilarious and interesting. I'd never heard of this guy before, and he is a wackadoodle, and I love it.
So anyway, thanks, Ben, for pointing that out.
He's also taken a photo of every meal he's eaten for the last 35 years. So just in case you're wondering, how obsessive this guy is, it's amazing.
So he was doing Instagram before Instagram.
He invented Instagram, I'm sure. That's patent for it. And if you say otherwise, he'll throw his death wig at you.
So let's see. Beej on Twitter wrote to remind us or mention that the countdown clock on the Whopper in War Games was run by an Apple II. So I think I had heard about that before. It's actually, there's a little bit of a mention of it even in the Wikipedia article on War Games. It says it was operated by a crew member sitting inside the computer entering commands into an Apple II at the director's instruction. It's kind of sad actually to hear this, but cool in the same way. Let's see. Maybe I'll stop there, actually. There's one more thing that somebody wrote in that Earl wants to steal for Chicken Lips Radio, so that's fine.
Yeah, sure.
So we can move on to...
So tune in to Chicken Lips Radio to find out more exciting news.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so we can turn to items of interest in news. Clearly very distinct from what we've just been doing. Carrington, you have the first one.
Hello Edit, it is called, and it is a Markdown editor disguised as a Macintosh Classic Era word processor. Specifically, imagine you are running Macintosh System 7 and you fired up Microsoft Word 5.1. That's what this looks like, but it runs on modern computers, and it's a Markdown editor. So Markdown is like a text-only thing. I use it quite a bit, so I like Markdown. I've never used a proper Markdown editor before, where you just, you know, hit Command B or press a little B button to make something bold, and it'll just throw the two stars on either side of it, and you can toggle back and forth between a preview of the finished text and the Markdown marked up stuff. And it's neat. And so it's available on GitHub and you can download it. So if you're looking for a Markdown editor, but you're yearning for old Macintosh System 7 stuff, which actually is right in my wheelhouse, then I'm totally the target market for this. Then you can head on over to GitHub to download it. It is also available online. So if you go to the link we have in the show notes, it'll head over to GitHub. That has a link to Hello Edit online. So if you want, you can try it out without having to install anything and just, you know, you go to a webpage, off you go typing, and if you do like it, then you can download it to have a version that runs on your own computer. If you want a fancy old Markdown editor looking super, super extra fancy and old, I like it. I dig it a lot.
That's cool.
Cool.
Huh. I had never heard of it. I do use Jupyter Notebook in the Python environment. I use Markdown a fair amount there.
What is Markdown?
It's like a text annotation system that is supposed to sort of give you readable text, you know, so it's in straight text, not fancy rich text, just ASCII text, and it allows you to mark up things that are supposed to be bold or italics or whatever, or links that then an interpreter can interpret. So you can get to the business of writing without having to deal with formatting, and you have stuff that's readable, much more readable than actual HTML.
Or like saving something as rich text, so like this is just text. But it's sort of like you agree that two stars in a row starts bold. And then so you'd have like star, star, the word bold, star, star. That means that word bold will be displayed in bold when you run it through let's say on the web or whatever. There's lots of, that's where I often use it. I'll write stuff in Markdown and then lots of blog editors on things will take the Markdown and throw it into HTML because it's designed to be very easily to go back and forth between HTML and Markdown. In fact, you can embed any HTML commands right in Markdown and it just works. That's part of the Markdown system. I think it was developed by John Gruber originally, the guy who does Daring Fireball, and I really like it. Like, there's some things I disagree with, the M and N dashes. I would have gone a different way with that, but it's nice, and it's super, super lightweight. So if you just want to type, and the nice thing is you end up with just a plain ASCII text file and kind of an agreement that this is how it would be displayed, bold and underscore and ordered and unordered lists and headlines and titles and all that, just with really easy key commands. And yet a text file that if you didn't understand Markdown, you could look at and go, oh yeah, I get the concept here. That's a numbered list and there's my title and stuff. So it's good and super lightweight. I like it. But I've never used a Markdown editor. I just use a plain text editor and just type in Markdown syntax because it's that easy.
Yeah, GitHub uses it actually extensively now that I think about it. So probably lots of people, you know, in their writing of the documentation and stuff like that, are familiar with Markdown.
But it's nice to use, right. Like the idea of this Hello Edit thing, to get back to that, is it's neat because it looks just like a System 7 word processor with the little buttons and save icons and all of that. So it's like you're typing in an old version of Word, but all it's really doing is loading and saving to plain text files that are in Markdown format. But it can display them in full bold and italics and all that if you want. And so I dig it. It's like a neat bridging between the two worlds with a really nice retro feel to it. So I like it a lot.
And Microsoft Word 5.1 was the best Microsoft Word.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely true.
No argument.
All right. Earl, you have the next thing.
So I just got done listening to Kevin Savitt's interview with Steve Moretzky of Infocom fame. Thought the interview was excellent, and also just kind of, you know, rekindle some of my interest in Infocom stuff just in general here. One of the news stories, and this was sent to us from Tony, and thank you, Tony, for this. there's a video on YouTube watching a playthrough of some of a game called Checkpoint. Checkpoint was a unreleased game from Infocom. There was some work done on the game, and then the work terminated, and I think some of the ideas might have morphed into some other Infocom games that came in the future. This was set in like a Cold War, seems like, setting, and watching some of the playthrough was interesting. Also, just the fact that when you bring the game up and start to run this particular Infocom game, there are notes that come up that show this was still in an alpha stage or a beta stage, like notes to people who might be testing it about some of the differences between this game and other Infocom games. For instance, in this particular game, you can't see behind you. It was one unique factor of Checkpoint. So I enjoyed that. I also noticed that there was a link that you could go to on GitHub under the historical source set of repositories for this particular game. And I just think that it's neat in general that, part of the reason that Kevin was doing this interview was a lot of the Infocom source had been recently released to GitHub. I'd never actually seen Zilcode before. I didn't know it was a variant of Lisp. I just find it all very fascinating. So I went over to the GitHub repository and was looking at it. I'm excited actually to read the book that Carrington, you know, catch me if I'm wrong here, but I think this book was written by Steve Moretzky on how to program in Zcode. Mm-hmm. And, yep. Although Steve Moretzky was kind of like wondering, like, why would you do this? Is this, you know, the best way to write interactive fiction today? Well, you know, maybe not, but it's a cool old school way to do it. And I'd be fascinated to understand the technology that they were using under the hood when they were making the huge catalog of games that Infocom made. So anyway, we'll have the links up in the show notes. You can go peruse it yourself and see what you think. And also take a look at a game that never actually saw the light of day, but sounds like it would have been kind of a fun game to play, actually.
It's neat, the video that we have in the show notes, I had actually tweeted about it earlier today. I didn't realize we were going to be talking about it on the show, or maybe I would have held back. And it's really good, but it's a fellow who's grabbed the source code for it and compiled it and played through a bit of the game. Stu Galley worked on this for about 6 months before abandoning it. So it's quite far along. Like, there's a lot of game there. In the same way that the sequel to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the restaurant at the end of the universe game, both of those are partially done games. So I would anticipate, and actually eagerly anticipate, that somebody or some groups of people are going to finish these games, at least insofar as making them compiled, ready-to-go versions. And I'm sure both of those will end up being playable games in the not-too-distant future. So that's really exciting, and a couple of things have come out of the unearthing of the Infocom source code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was going to say, actually, just thinking, you know, tangenting off on what Earl was saying about, you know, why would somebody write something in ZIL today? I mean, I think one thing that's actually kind of cool about it is that it is constrained in a way that probably, you know, a modern language wouldn't be. I mean, like, it's interesting to see how to work within the constraints of, even if this is more powerful than Scott Adams' adventures or whatever, I mean, it's still, it's still kind of interesting to see how one dealt with those constraints of having to be very small and you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So, you know.
Free verse isn't poetry, man.
Excellent. Jack, with the Atari, you have something.
Yeah, so we've talked, we mentioned earlier in this podcast already the thing of where we're using SD card readers of different kinds as replacements for floppies on all of the old platforms, a common pattern. So I've been using one with my Atari stuff that I've had for 4 or 5 years. It's called SD2SIO, which it works and it's fine, but the interface is always kind of clunky. It has a little 1 or 2 line display only on the device itself and like 4 or 5 buttons. So like basically if you want to do things like, okay, I'm going to boot up with these 4 floppies in and start the computer that way, and then I need to swap out the 4th floppy for another one while things are running, you can do it. You can navigate the interface somehow to do it, but it's not straightforward. It's not easy. Just as an example of something that is tricky to do with this. So there's an alternative, and I first heard of this a while ago, but I see it bubbling up more and more. It's a thing called the S-Drive Max. And what it is a similar idea, but a different implementation. It's built on an Arduino, so if you want, you can build it yourself. You buy an Arduino board, you buy a screen shield, and so it has a big screen, I don't know, 3-inch screen or something like that. A nice big color screen, touch screen, with which you can navigate the interface. So you can see the four drives you have mapped up, tap on a button to change one, and navigate through your directories to find the disk image you want to use. You can also map up a file you want to use as a cassette image. So if you want to, if you have some software that's on cassette that you need to emulate, you can do that with this as well. So it's pretty neat. And there's at least one guy building and selling these. I think right now they're like $85. And I've got a nice video of Nir Derry, who's big in the Atari scene, demonstrating this thing from just a couple weeks ago. And it's quite cool. Like, it's compared to other solutions I've seen, it's nice because it actually gives you a useful, usable interface. It feels like a much more sophisticated way to do it instead of messing around with a tiny screen and some buttons that don't make any sense.
It seems relatively cheap, too.
So I have some links. And also the software for it is open source. It's all on GitHub. So if you want to mess with it and enhance your thing, you can do that. I think I saw some photos or a video of someone who had just like translated the interface into Spanish or Portuguese, that kind of thing. So it's all totally tweakable. You can image whatever you want on the Arduino you have in there, and off you go.
So, all right, so it looks like it's built on an Arduino Uno, like sort of prefabricated board, right?
Yes.
I was thinking about this when we were talking about this before, but I wonder if there's a, you know, sort of opportunity here to, if this is really just sort of pretty much off the shelf, you know, already built board, couldn't we do this for a lot of computers? Like, would it not be possible to make such a thing that could connect to your Atari or to your Commodore or to your Apple, you know, by changing the...
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, yeah, by having a different plug on it, basically. Yeah. So this is wired up with an SIO connector. The software would need to be extended to understand other disk formats and how to shuffle those over to the computer asking for them. But yeah, in principle, I don't see why not.
So that seems like, I mean, if somebody could make this successfully, that would be part of the solution, perhaps, to, you know, Earl's problem of having to spend too much money on all the little devices for all the different computers. If you had one device that you could plug into all of them,
that would be super cool. Interesting. So, anyway, I've been looking at this. I have not bought one or anything, but I'm thinking about it. And I have a link to one guy who is selling them. It's on vintagecomputercenter.com. And he's selling them pre-made, pre-assembled, with a variety of case colors. And, I mean, if you're handy with a soldering iron, you can just buy all the parts yourself. You don't need to do this. But if you're not that handy, or just want the comfort of having someone else built it for you and having already tested it and stuff, there you go.
It's kind of cool that you can get these cases in a bunch of different colors, you know, blue, red,
right,
white, black, or whatever. But I like that there's one of them is gold, which I think that, I mean, it looks like a yellowed little device that'll look perfect next to your, you know,
yeah,
big yellowed.
Properly super, super yellowed thing.
Fragilistic expialidocious.
Exactly.
And the this case design is somewhat reminiscent of the Atari XL computer line with like these diagonal notches and stuff. So it's kind of neat.
Oh, so that actually probably wouldn't yellow.
Right. Well, I think XLs can also yellow somewhat. I'm not sure. Maybe this beige one is about it.
All right. Let's see. So I have the next one. This one is very short, but it's just sort of a slightly amusing, slightly terrifying story and it's not exactly vintage computing related, but it's sort of vintage tech related. It's a story about a guy who was restoring a classic synthesizer. So let's see, who is this? Elliot Curtis. And he said, you know, he agreed to fix and restore a Buchla, I guess, Model 100 modular synthesizer that was owned by Cal State University. And So he started working on this, and as he was disassembling a module that seemed to have been added afterwards, there was some kind of residue under one of the knobs, and he tried to dislodge it and blasted it with a cleaning solvent and stuff, and wound up going on a 9-hour acid trip.
Because it was LSD.
Yeah. And that's pretty awful.
Can you imagine, like, if you don't think you've done any drugs, but suddenly you're on acid?
Yeah.
That'd be, like, terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, man. Hopefully you'd be sort of clear-headed enough to guess what's happening, but...
It happened to a girlfriend of mine once, weirdly. Her father had some brownies that she didn't know were pot brownies. And so she ate them, and it calls me going, like, I think I'm, like, super sick. So it turns out she's, like, just, like, tripping balls. So I take her to the hospital, because she has no idea. Like, she didn't think she had consumed anything, but turns out she's, like, on drugs and just didn't know it. We broke up soon afterwards, because when she was at the hospital, she told me, like, if anything happens to her, to make sure that I tell some other dude that she loves him. I'm like, well, what the hell is this? Like, that was the story of my life. And I remember, Jessica, you did me so wrong. But the same thing kind of happened to her. Like, you don't think you've done drugs, and suddenly you're on drugs. So I can imagine this guy must have just been, like, freaking out.
Yeah. But, there's a slightly comic element to this this story, because it wasn't, everybody survived. but it does make you pause a little bit. If you're going to be repairing some old thing that's been sitting in who knows where, is there some toxic substance on it, some diseased mouse left something behind or something, it's
the electric Kool-Aid Kansas Fest.
Yeah. it drives home the point that you might actually be wise to, wear gloves or something, or when you're first addressing hardware you don't know the provenance of. Anyway, that's it. I thought it was interesting and strange. Carrington.
Paul.
You can talk about the, I remember this. This is, whatever. Tell us about it.
I'll tell you about it. This is, John Leake is a wonderful, brilliant madman, and he's created the Apple II Slice, which is such a silly name. So he had an Apple IIe case that was cracked and really broken beyond repair. And so instead of just chucking out, what he did was he sliced off the front of it and some other pieces. So you imagine an Apple IIe where all you have is the keyboard, and then it goes back far enough to be just past the Apple II badge, and then that's it, like a little stubby keyboard, kind of the size of a normal keyboard, but, 6 inches taller, however the heck thick an Apple IIe is. And he's stuck in, I think it's an Arduino inside it that runs an Apple II emulator. So it becomes this keyboard. It's really only the keyboard for an Apple II, but it's a full Apple II emulator inside it. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's weird. So you've got the advantage of the small size of a keyboard, but all the disadvantage of the crazily bad ergonomics of the height of the Apple II keyboard. So he preserved that part. but it's lovely. Like, it's really nice looking. It looks like something that would have come out with the Apple III. Like, it really looks like that kind of weird era. They would have said, yeah, here's your keyboard. It's 6 inches deep and it's 6 inches tall. What do you want from us? Like, it's beautiful. He did such a good job. Like, it looks like something that just came out from Apple. I love it. I think it's a work of mad genius, and it'd be fitting because he's such a good guy. So I love this thing.
Yeah, it does look a little bit reminiscent of, a VIC-20 or an Atari, one of the XL ones. Like, it's just a unit that is basically just a keyboard.
Right.
With that crazy height.
Yeah.
That is cool.
Oh, Apple IIe, you are so tall.
So tall.
But yeah, I mean, I think, we were talking a little bit about... what it takes to get the retro experience versus an emulator. And this is actually kind of a nice optimization of that. You get the actual keyboard, you're running an emulator, you don't have all the space that it takes up. You can't use slots, I guess, but whatever, you can emulate a slot.
But if it's emulated, you can emulate things in the slots, exactly. And so this is the Apple IIs for slice, so because it's been sliced. And it's so nice, though. It's just like... It is the best version of this that something could be. It's, like, remarkably well done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was very, very, very impressed.
The very first thing it says is, first and foremost, I would never have done this project with an intact 2E. So.
Well, you have to say that, otherwise there'll be, like, a tidal wave of hate from the internet.
Yeah.
because that, you know, internet. But it's lovely. He did such a good job. He's a talented, wonderful madman. And has his own podcast, too, which you can listen to instead of this one, or in addition to
Retro Madcast. Yeah,
which is very good. Everyone should subscribe.
It's amazing how, and I've seen other people do this, too, do this plastic work and have it come out still looking so professional and so nice.
I know, right?
I mean, it's just it's artistic.
The skill is crazy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I see stuff like this, when somebody does like work in plastic like this, it's because it's so far beyond anything I've ever attempted. Like, I don't know how to do that kind of thing. My mind always boggles. Like, I'll look at something like this and think, well, how did you do that? It looks like it came out of a factory. Like, it's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so good. He's did such a good job.
Also, there are a lot of 2Es out there. It might actually even be okay to do it on an intact 2E.
And a tidal wave of hate points itself at Paul.
All right, Earl, you have the next thing.
Yeah, so again, speaking of these cool modern-day add-ons for our old retro computers, here's a product name that just rolls right off the tongue.
I think.
Yeah, Unijoystickle 2. I just love saying that. This is an adapter that goes into the 9-pin standard Atari joystick ports and lets you use Bluetooth style controls. Like, I think in the video they're actually using a PS4 controller, but if you go to the GitHub, that again we'll have this link in the show notes, you can see the plans for making this. I didn't actually see or know of anyone who's building these commercially, so I mean, maybe you have to buy it yourself, but or build it yourself, sorry. But all the plans are there, and this is one of the things that I really love about a lot of the work that's going on right now in these modern-day add-ons is instead of keeping them proprietary and, you know, holding their arms around them, me, people are just releasing the plans so that, and I think that does two things. One is it's cool that you can understand how these add-ons work if you want to. I mean, you can dig in, really understand like all of how it works. But the second thing is, in a lot of these cases, when it's a commercial project and then the person gets bored and walked away, we've talked before about how these things become unobtainium at that point. But if they post everything to GitHub and, you know, you got the plans up there for the chips and the PCBs and all that, then it's always available in some sense. I mean, meaning you could always build one if you were determined enough to do it. But the GitHub says this will allow you to use Bluetooth gamepads like, for instance, an Xbox One gamepad in old computers like the Commodore 64 and 128. And on the GitHub, they show what the mapping is of the modern-day controllers to if you had an old classic joystick. I just think it's really cool. Anyway, there's a video of this actually functioning, somebody playing a game with a new modern controller, so check it out, and it's fun.
Yeah, this when you were talking about that, it reminded me of something that was sort of similar, made for the Apple II, called the AP40. There was a Kickstarter a couple of years ago.
I remember that.
And so, and you know, that looked really, it looks really cool. It's actually there's a Bluetooth receiver that you plug into the Apple II, and then there's a controller that you can get that has all the Apple colors on it and stuff. But one of the things that was not good about that was that the Apple II, and I think the IBM also, IBM PC, has an analog joystick. So it's not just up or not up. It's, you know, degrees of up. And so the AP40 actually, the reviews were not good on it because, it can only do up, not up, down, not down. And so, you know, it was actually a pretty terrible experience, but it seems like for the computers that do use just sort of digital joysticks like that, then the, like I think the Unijoystickle 2 does,
right.
then this might work a lot better.
Well, on some of those modern day controllers, they do have the little thumb joystick. Like I know some of them have the little actual, thumb analog joystick that has degrees. It's an actual, like a potentiometer kind of thing, not like just a binary switch.
Yeah, and it looks like the AP40 has even two of those, but are those not mapped to anything on the Apple then?
Oh, well, I think it's conceivable that it's a firmware issue, that they could maybe read a number and send it, but they didn't. I kind of stopped following it after a while. I know that that was something that they were intending to address because they got a fairly, you know, large amount of dissatisfaction from that initially.
Right.
So I think it is probably something that they could do in software, given what they had, but I don't know if they ever got to it. All right. That's it for the news. I'll maybe just make a quick note in the upcoming show roundup. So we've talked before about Kansas Fest in mid-July, VCF West in Mountain View, California, August 3rd to 4th, Fujiyama 2019, August 26th to September 4th. And a new addition here is the Tandy Assembly 2019, which will be in Springfield, Ohio, September 27th to 29th. And Randy posted about this on the Facebook group, saying, "We are very excited to announce that we are adding a day this year to Tandy Assembly and will be offering a new Friday feature called Tandy Tech Track. This will be a selection of highly technical topics presented by some of the leading figures in the Tandy Radio Shack TRS-80 vintage computing community." So he says, "We need exhibitors, sponsors, auction donations, and speakers." So if you are in this world, go check that out. This is quite recent news as of recording. So any of you going? September 27th. End of September, yeah.
I am not.
Yeah.
But it does appeal to me greatly. I love old Tandy stuff. It makes my heart sing. So this kind of thing does have a lot of appeal.
I think that if I were a person who really liked Tandy stuff, I would want to refer to myself as a Tandy dandy.
I will be.
But there's too many ifs there, so it's like it doesn't work out.
No, it'll work out. We're gonna make that work.
Yeah. I'd almost work backwards from that, knowing that I could be called a Tandy dandy. I will now adopt the TRS-80.
Into Tandy. Absolutely. Yeah.
Suddenly, it seems cool.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tandy!
Right.
Some people have big plans after school. You know what Elliot's going to do? Jeff, too. Elliot's at work on a book report using Scripcit on Radio Shack's Color Computer 3. It hooks up to his TV. And Jeff's at his Radio Shack Color Computer 3 playing the newest football game. But wait, what's Elliot doing playing new Super Pitfall? And Jeff's having a blast with a new math tutor. You never know what you might try with more than 100 programs for fun and learning. Radio Shack's Color Computer 3 comes with everything you see here. Other items each sold separately. Only at Radio Shack.
It can talk to computers. It can talk to fax machines. It can talk. It fits in your briefcase. It fits in your business. It fits in your life. But the remarkable thing isn't just what it can do. It's what it can become. Introducing PowerBook Duo from Apple.
And we're back. All right, so for the Hosts Retro Computing gift idea, we've recently been decorating our houses, I guess, with these. But the next in this series is a retro computer comforter, which is wonderful. It's basically stylized something kind of like an old Mac. I mean, it's not exactly like anything in particular, but it's got a black screen with green letters on it that says "Hello," and it's got a sort of 3.5-inch Mac-like disk drive image.
Mm, and it's kind of old Mac color, that beige, but the "Hello" is just a green font, kind of like what you'd have on an Apple II, but not really.
So it's not sort of mimicking. Well, actually, in fact, it's 7-segment displays. Who knows what this is supposed to be, but it looks kind of cool.
It does.
You can get it in various sizes. It's basically just like, I forget what they call it, but it's one of these sites where somebody submits a design and then you can have it on a mug or a shirt or a hat or, you know, whatever. And this designer has designed a bunch of other things as well, not just this. But so you have, because it's kind of made to order, you can choose, you know, what size you want, and the smallest is a twin at $100, and the largest is a king at $150. And if you apparently today, as we record, it's on sale. But I don't know if that's going to still be true when you look at this in the future.
Every time I go to the site, it pops up a, hey, do you want to save 30%? Sign up email thing. So I suspect it's the kind of site that has discounts all the time. You can see other comforters from the same artist. It's one of those type of sites. And this artist must be in Toronto or know Toronto, because there's a number of comforters which are designed around subway stops here in the city. Ah. There's the Keele subway stop and Don Mills and Davisville. And they have kind of the tile pattern you'd see in that subway station. So they must be somebody local. So I say, well done you.
That's pretty cool. I'd seen those, but the names didn't mean anything to me. Now I know.
Yeah, the first one I saw was St. Clair. I'm like, that brick St. Clair, that looks like the St. Clair subway station. I'm like, oh, yeah, and you're of Davisville. Yeah, you're 100% doing our subway.
Toronto's the one. Cool. Toronto has, if I remember right, like a comically simple subway system, like a U and a crossbar.
Yep. We've added bits to it, but it is, yeah, it's, I mean, it's super handy, but only if you're right along the very narrow lines of where our subway goes. Yep. Unlike other cities, alas, you think with our weather, we would have a much better subway system. But we didn't build it at the time, and now it's a pain to retrofit it. Boo.
All right. Anyway, so you know, go get the comforter and the pillow from the previous one and the hat. You'll be all set. All right. We can now turn to eBay auctions. And I am not the only one with multiple ones this time. So Harrington can start with his multiples.
Mr. All Emulator has three different auctions for things to buy. I talk a big game, and I pick a bunch of eBay things. So I'm going to slow things down and talk. No, I'm kidding. So the first one is, I love cassettes. I love audio cassettes. I love old games on cassettes. Like, that's one of the nice things that the ZX Spectrum had, is so much of their software came out on cassette. And I do know that the reality of software on cassettes is a nightmare of slow loads and failed loads and whatever. But cassettes are just like physically so lovely. There's just something about them. And so this is an auction for 25 ZX Spectrum games. So 25 different cassettes. And I just love them. And it's starts at, I think it's 15 pounds, which is less than $20. So if it doesn't go too high, this would be a great way to like kind of kick off a collection. I have no idea about really any of these games because I'm not a ZX Spectrum guy, but I just like the whole big collection of cassettes, and they look lovely. So that was my first choice, is I dig cassettes. Cassettes are great, except to use, which is unfortunate. So my second one, I don't understand what it is. So somebody is selling a new old computer, and that's the entirety of the description. It's a photo of a computer kind of lit up, but it's inside a box. So what I don't understand is, when you look at it, there's a cardboard box, a Russian, I guess, computer inside it, something where it's got like a weird display, and I think it's Cyrillic, and I think it's called the KP-03 as a computer, but I Googled it, couldn't find any information. And what caught my eye was, even though the computer is sitting inside its box, I guess they powered it on because it's got this weird ethereal green glow inside it, which is kind of strange. And what caught my eye was, not only is it a computer in Cyrillic, the keyboard, they've gone a bit crazy with the arrow keys. So there's arrow keys all over it. There's down arrows, there's up arrows, there's a set of four arrows in the corner. The return key is double height and has a huge arrow with an L. And every key has a different size arrow. They kind of made them thicker. Depending on how thick the key is, we'll just make the arrow bigger. So there's no consistency at all. It's like the worst. Oh my goodness. It's so awful. It's amazing. And just every time I look, I see more arrows. Like, there's up in the function keys, which has K1 through 5. There's also like an NC key, a blank key, and then a key with an arrow that also has a bit of a hook to it. Because, you know, hey, maybe you want to, I don't know. I have no idea what half these arrow keys do, but I'm in love with them. So it's new, it's old, it's computer, and it's got lots of arrow keys. Starting bid of $100 US. That's what I know. It's in Russia, and I think it's great. So if I was going to start up a new collection, this might be what I would consider, just to hit those arrow keys and see what happens. So that's two of my three choices. And choice number three is one of those things like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Say a couple things about this one.
So, oh, do you? Okay, I thought we were moving. Yeah, I thought we were shaking. I'm listening to my host.
So one thing about the, so if you want to look this one up, you look up KR03 because it's sort of,
okay. Thank you.
And one thing that's kind of cool about this is it comes with a little cassette and some kind of manual, although probably you need to be able to read Russian. We We've linked this before at some point.
Have we?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we've talked about this before.
With these crazy arrow keys, this didn't ring a bell
at all.
The
arrow keys is a new discovery.
Okay. Because that's why I picked
and
it.
A new discovery for me also is that the little flying guy on the top, there's like a little cartoon guy carrying what looks like an oversimplified version of the computer drawn in the box.
I think he has like a helicopter blade sticking out.
Yes, so I believe this is an Astrid Lindgren character called Carlson on the Roof.
You might be right.
Because he's a weird little guy who also flies with a weird helicopter pack. I don't know. It just makes less sense. It just adds to the mystery.
Yep. It's a very, very strange thing. I think these were some versions of these were build it yourself computers. So they came as a kit. This one might have come built. I don't really know, but let's see. Somewhere it says here it's a Intel 8080A clone is what's running it inside. Yeah. Anyway, it's I do love the description of this new old computer. I mean, doesn't get much better than that.
What else do you need to know?
Exactly.
What else could possibly interest you?
Anywhere you want to go, it has an arrow pointing that direction.
That's right.
Of various thicknesses.
Okay. Anyway, yeah.
And my last choice is, suppose you're in your car, you're driving along, you decide to listen to some classic music. So you turn on the radio, there used to be radios, kids, look it up, or you turn on some digital streaming thing, and you listen to like classic rock, and it plays a song that you distinctly remember as being not that long ago. Like you think, that's not classic rock, that's from like after I was in university, and you realize you're a million years old. Well, so was my experience when I'm just browsing through vintage computers today to pick things for the auction, and in there is an Apple 2008 MacBook Air. I'm like, really? Really, kids? Like, and so apparently, because if you think about it, that's like 11 years old. So the MacBook Air is now retro enough to be in the vintage section of eBay.
Yeah.
I was like, oh God, I'm a million. I'm officially a million. So that's why I have to calculate how old I am. So it kind of tickled me and horrified me at the same time. That this person chose to list the 2008 MacBook Air in the vintage section on eBay.
Look how fat that is, though. I mean, I feel like...
It can fit in an envelope, provided your envelope is massive.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of feel like, yeah, this is a recent tech and, you know, whatever. It doesn't deserve to be retro, but it really does actually... Like, the design has advanced a lot since then.
Mm-hmm. Because it's got that weird flip-down thing for the ports, which I think was only the first version of that. I'd never had that version of the
Air. I'd never seen that before.
All the versions I had didn't have that.
Oh, I forgot about that.
It's like, what was the name of that car? Well, I guess there were a number of cars that had the headlights that would wake up.
Oh, yeah. One would wake up. How many times you drive down, it's like the one blinky headlight sticking up. Those things failed horrendously often.
Yeah. What a good idea. Add one more point of failure.
Exactly. And just a little thing with your headlights.
Yeah.
No problem if those don't work. Oh, it's turned on. It's just still facing inside your hood.
Right.
Anyway, those are my three choices, and I'm horrified by the third one.
All right. Earl, what do you have?
So I have a vintage working IBM Model M clicky mechanical keyboard. So the thing that I really liked about this was that they were opening it up for a very reasonable buy-it-now price of $59. And it's just $11 shipping to me. Looked like it had a PS2 connector, but for some reason they also have a PS2 to AT, you know, the old 5-pin DIN style connector. So I don't know what this keyboard was connected to in its past. Can't tell you, but I can tell you that the keyboard overall looks like it's in very nice shape. And, you know, these clicky keyboards are kind of the rage for collectors. So I just picked this because I love the old buckling spring IBM mechanical keyboards, and I thought this was a decent price for a decent keyboard that they say works.
And starting bid for if you want to just do the auction thing of only one penny.
Yeah.
That is how to do an auction.
The price strikes me as cheap. Like the buy it now price strikes me as pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah. $59 is incredibly cheap for these computers. They go for much more than that. Paul just bought himself a keyboard.
It says in the description that it was cleaned three times since 1998. Never know what level of detail you need. I guess it's now time for me. All right. So I have you know, a little pile here. The first one is, we've been talking a bit. Actually, is it still? Yeah, we've been talking a bit about these Thunder Mountain things. So I think that I'd found an auction of some, you know, like a big, fairly large set of these Thunder Mountain things for. I think that they exist for at least Commodore and Apple II, maybe Atari also. This was basically just a redistributor of, you know, that would buy distribution rights for software that went off the market. And now essentially the secret is revealed in this auction of, like, where, you know, how, what this seller had, because the seller had, you know, these like sets of 10 and 12 and stuff of just like various titles of these. And they were sort of impressive by themselves, but it seems like the seller has now given up and is selling a case of Master Types Figures and Formulas for the Apple II. So if you want 50 of this one educational software thing, the seller no longer wants to deal with it.
Yep, and I see the seller also has more. They have 12 of something or 20. No, those are different ones. Sorry.
Yeah, so those are the sets.
Right. Those are the ones you're talking. Those are the sets, right?
And so, you know, I'm thinking, this is not an opportunity. Like, you are not going to get this and then be able to, you know, make your money back selling off individual copies of Master Types Figures and Formulas for the Apple II. In the off-brand version.
But someone could buy this, and it could be a fun party favor. K-Fest.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody gets Master Types Figures and Formulas.
Yeah.
In your goodie bag.
Might almost be a good idea.
Like, you can set up a bunch of computers and do it as a classroom type thing. Today we're going through this. If you look at the other auctions by the same seller, because they're the ones doing all the bulk games for Thunder Mountain, some of them, since they puts the, I'm presuming it's a guy, puts the cases on the ground to take photos, there's often photos with, like, his foot sticking in.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. It's like, here's these five games and my toe.
Yeah. It does seem like in this era of easily edited photos, what are you doing? How do you let that go through?
100%.
Okay. So the next thing, I had sort of the same experience independently, although this one is older, but I found a graphite Apple iBook clamshell. Seashells. See what? but anyway.
I always like these. I always like the iBook clamshells. Yeah. I know they're big and kind of ridiculous, but they got the handle built in and they're lovely OS 9 computers, and the keyboard's a bit spongy, but I've always had a soft spot for these things. I think they're great. Like, they're so unique. They are just their own thing.
Yeah, I really do like this. This machine was my main one for a couple of years. And I did really like it. Yeah, there's something. It feels very rugged. It's not, one thing that isn't super rugged about these is the logo on the back. There's this single color Apple that sits, you know, like, it's embedded a little bit in the case when it's closed. You can see it, but they fall off, and particularly the leaf falls off. So this one has it. Oh, and the graphite one was good too, because it was the special edition one. It was the fancy one, the faster one. You know, couple.
But I still have a soft spot for, like, the blueberry and the orange. You get well one, like, just go colorful. They're great. I think they're awesome. I don't know how useful they'd actually be, but it's from that era where Apple was just doing its own thing, man.
Yeah,
it's great.
I think I turned mine on. It might have been as much as a year ago, but I mean, like, I feel like I've recently turned it on. Every once in a while, I'll turn it on and marvel at how terrible the trackpad is.
Oh, you're right. When I read the description for this, it says has both pieces of the Apple logo. The bottom one is the original, and the top piece came from a Snow iBook and is glued in and colored black.
Oh, no.
I wondered why it looked a little weird.
Yeah. Oh, well, I didn't notice that. But anyway, yeah, so it's kind of retro. It feels a little too new, but I like them. And I, you know, it occupies that same kind of spot in my heart. Okay, next thing I have, I don't know if this is interesting at all, is a IBM systems pad of blank multiple card layout forms. I just thought it was interesting that this existed. I guess it's for doing something with punch cards. Does anyone have any idea? Maybe it's just nothing.
Mm-hmm. Michael might know. But it's a card layout of some sort, because it says multiple card layout forms. So I presume it's punch cards,
yeah,
or bubble, the fill-in cards or something like that. Some sort of card versus a tape.
Yeah, or it's like a scorekeeping form for some gambling thing they did at IBM. Anyway, if this means something to you, it might be interesting to see it again. I will now move on to Control Data Corporation, a mini computer. And when I think of mini
computer... That word doesn't mean what you think it means.
it's like a small little LCD clock that says Control Data on it, and, you know, kind of looks like a... it's a keyboard attached to a monitor. I kind of like it, actually. It looks pretty cool. And it comes with something that I think is an Allen wrench device of some kind. But anyway, it's kind of cute. It's a little thing. $26 buy it now, basically. And actually, I always kind of like the Control Data logo too. I'm not gonna get it, but you might, listener.
Maybe you.
Okay. This came up in my search. The next thing is it's a newer technology, MicroDock for PowerBook Duo computers. And, you know, so this is, you know, back now we're talking essentially that early Mac era. The Mac Duo was like an early experiment of like having a super lightweight computer, you know, low profile computer that had a dock that you could put it into. So if you wanted a big monitor and big hard drive and memory, and I think it could even be in there, you could slide it into a dock and it slides in kind of like a cassette, a VHS tape. They're fairly amusing things. But and I loved my Duo. I had
I loved my Duo too.
I didn't have a dock, actually. I just had the Duo. I didn't have the mega dock. But one thing that you could get with these is that there was a smaller micro dock or mini dock that you could put on the back. There were sort of three sizes. There was the big one that sucked it in like a cassette tape. And then there was, I think, the mini dock, which was just sort of like a little shelf that you set it on. You know, so you plugged it in and gave it some extra ports and some feet. And I don't know, I guess the feet were on it. But anyway, it gave it extra ports, more, you know, so it was sort of, it didn't have all the capacity of the big dock, Duo dock, but it had a lot of the ports available. That's the thing I had. And then there were these micro docks, which were just like, you plugged them in, they're like little semicircle things that you plug in the back, and they give you a couple of ports, like for a disk drive. Okay, that's a very long story. The reason I'm pointing this one out is newer technology made a third-party dock. You know, so Apple made the micro dock itself, but newer technology made a third-party one that had a couple different configurations. This one has an Ethernet connector. That was a very long story to get up to. This one has an Ethernet connector. that is pretty great, because, you know, the Duo doesn't... It's not easy to get Ethernet set up on the Duo. Like, you can use one of these, and I've forgotten what it's called, but the little dongle things that convert Ethernet to ADB. But this, or, you know, what is that called? Carrington, you would know this, would you not?
Yeah, I had one of
the little things that look like stingrays.
Yeah, Etherwave.
Yes. Farallon Etherwave. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I had one of those too. But I had this exact one, like the newer one. I loved newer tech stuff. I bought a bunch of other things back in the day. And I had both this one and the one of these that's a SCSI. It was like the square SCSI, HD20, I think it was called, something like that. And so I had both the Ethernet one and the SCSI docks for my Duo. I had like a Duo, I think a 280 and then eventually a 2100. And I had the full cassette, you know, put it in thing at work. And then at home, I had a collection of these little micro dock things, all bought by work, thank you, because not mine. These things were expensive as heck. And I loved it. That was such a... I know now if I picked up a Duo, I'd be like, why is this 10,000 pounds? But my memory is it was lovely and sleek and beautiful and a great combo of desktops sometimes. And it was just, it was a view of the future that could have been.
The screen is so small. Heavy, that's another one that I turn on occasionally, and the screen is laughably small. Like, right. There's a lot of margin around the edge.
Yeah, we're so used to these teeny tiny bezels now. Look at old ones. You're like, whoa, my goodness, what? Yeah. But still, I have a real soft spot for them and for newer tech in general. They made a I had a modem adapter thingy, like one of those modems that you strap onto a phone, like it Velcros onto a telephone handset so you could use a payphone or whatever, and it would plug into a Duo and give you a modem on the road for when you're like, I don't know, doing scenes out of the movie Hackers or something. It was great. Neuer was a great company. They make great stuff.
And so I've been sort of keeping my eye out for this. I mean, it's conceivable that I'll buy this before I finish editing, but because these come up, the Ethernet ones specifically, the SCSI ones come up pretty commonly, but the Ethernet ones specifically come up pretty rarely, and often get snapped up. This is a, it's an auction. I can't step in and buy it. But
but you could always delay producing this episode.
It's a cool thing, though, regardless of who gets this one. Okay, let's see. The next thing is, I didn't know anything about this until I saw the auction. It is a Sword computer, a Sword M223 Mark II. And it looks... I like the look of it, basically, is the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's very strange. There's two... There's a second Sword computer. There's a 223 and also... M100.
M100, I think. Yeah. Both by Sword. I've never even heard of Sword before. It's just S-O-R-D, like no W.
The thing that's remarkable about this auction is that it's got a lot of stuff. So it's got apparently two computers, one of which comes with a Sword-specific monitor and drives. But it's also got boxes. It's, you know, Sword diskettes, Sword parts, computer parts. There's a Sword banner you can hang on your wall if you want, and manuals and brochures. And so if you were at all interested in the history of this computer, there's a lot of stuff in here. It is in Lawrence, Kansas, so it's actually pretty not super far away from where Kansas Fest is, I guess. I don't know, how big is Kansas? Maybe that's like saying it's in Australia, it must be near it if you're also in Australia. But yeah. But it's a $3,000 buy it now. It is not available for shipping. So, although the seller says, you know, it's located in the direct center of the United States, so it's equally inconvenient for everybody, pretty much. That was my addition. This seller did not say that. What did the seller actually say? Could maybe meet someone halfway, if not too far. I'm smack dab in the middle of the USA.
I've never even heard of Sword before. And all the manuals and stuff are in English. So, because it looks like the kind of computer that also might have been something only released in the Ukraine or something, except it's all in English, and I just don't know it. Like, and it's neat, and it's somebody who was clearly super into them because they got the original one, the M100, and then upgraded to this M200 Mark II or whatever, and has a whole bunch of manuals about it and a bunch of cassettes and discs, and somebody was really into their Sword stuff.
So...
Well, there are one thing I noticed is that the fifth picture in, it shows like some marketing materials, kind of like some with like people sitting at desks, a woman sitting on a floor or something. These people all look, it's fuzzy, but they look vaguely Asian. Could this be something that was initially made and marketed in Asia and was then also brought to the US in a limited amount?
Yeah, I think that's could possible.
Be, could be.
Because also the sixth photo, the pile of documents, at least one document has stuff on its cover that is in
Japanese, because it's got some
Japanese.
It's got some katakana in there.
Yeah. So there you go.
Two things I've now learned about Sword Computer Corporation. It was indeed Japanese, founded in 1970. It's now the Toshiba Personal Computer System Corporation. It's a subsidiary of Toshiba. But Sword, and you would never have guessed this, comes from a contraction of software and hardware. They took the SO from software, and weirdly, the RD from hardware.
Like you do.
Why not call it the SOHA or whatever? But it's the Sword for software and hardware.
Yeah. Cool.
I also had never heard of this. Apparently it's a Z80 computer, like the X80 Sorcerer.
Yeah, nice. The M200 came out in 1977, so it's late 70s stuff. Very cool. Yeah. And it ran Kanji CPM. I dig it. I dig everything about this.
Yeah, and I mean, this set is fantastic. So, I mean, it's, if you had any interest in this, it, and you were like in an adjacent state, it might be worth going. Anyway, yeah, so now we know that. The next couple are just like a couple little things that I saw. So one is, there's a auction for an IBM 5150 PC. It says with original monitor, keyboard, printer, manuals, and software. The thing that jumped out at me is that the monitor that they're using is, it's an Amdek Color 2. So it's not an IBM monitor. It's not the original monitor that you think of, not the sort of, I don't know what, iconic one that you see on 5150s. I mean, I love the Amdek Color 1 and Color 2. I think they are great monitors. That's what I grew up with. So that's partly why I'm biased toward them. It looks to me like an Apple monitor because of this. But it, if you look at the back, there's actually, you know, there's a connector. There's a connector that is not, you know, it's not composite. It's something else that I guess you would use to plug into the PC.
Well, it must be CGA RGB compatible, right? Because I'm imagining this has a CGA card in it.
Yeah.
It looks like a CGA card with the 9-pin female plug on the back, as well as the composite out. That feels like a CGA card to me.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful setup.
The connector at the back of the monitor is, I don't quite understand it. It looks like it's 8 pins kind of angled or something. So I don't know what the connector is supposed to look like. But however, I do have a...
Wait, the one on the card? It's a 9-pin?
No, on the back of the monitor.
Oh, the monitor, I don't know. Because I can see the card sticking out of the... Or in the IBM, which has an RGB plug and a 9-pin connector. Yeah.
But so, I do have... I think I have some in-person experience with this particular version of this monitor. Because when I was a kid on Christmas, you know, at one point... family decided, all right, we're going to get the family an Apple II. You know, you're spending all your time on the school's one. You know, we think you could use this here. But it's for the family. But really, you know, we know who's going to use it.
Sure. Just like we'll get that dog, but dad will never walk it. Whatever.
But so you know, we got the thing. You know, it was an Apple II Plus and monitor and a joystick and a key and a disk drive and stuff. And but this was the monitor that we got. So, it was Christmas, and we had a monitor that had no connector that I could connect to the Apple II. So it had this thing.
Oh my gosh!
And so, in fact, actually, the first thing I did on this Apple II was basically like some blind programming, you know, where you like guess a number and it would beep a number of times, like whether you were correct or not.
That you had to program without a display? That's amazing.
You know, you can't wait. So, but
no. That would be a good Hackfest or an Apple II competition. Like, there's computer setup. You're given a task. You have no monitor. Go. Right. Do the following. Keep it in your head.
That is an interesting idea. I've seen a similar thing in modern times where it's a web programming thing. Like you're given a design for what a web page ought to look like. And they say, okay, now go edit some HTML and some CSS and don't preview it until we're done.
Oh, no.
So everybody sits for like 45 minutes or an hour editing their CSS and HTML, but cannot preview it. And they're all on stage and there are judges walking around looking to make sure no one cheats. And then so everyone is just like coding in the blind. And then at the end, they're shown all one at a time. Whoever is kind of closest gets a prize or something.
You accidentally have...
I can't do that even if I can preview. CSS is a nasty mistress.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just an accidental open, you know, like less than character could wipe out half your page.
Yep. Right. Yep.
The greatest trick the devil ever played was to tell you that tables were a bad way to make websites.
Okay. And then, let's see, the last thing is, it is a Novation Cat 300 baud acoustic coupler. And I just think, you know, this is kind of cool. I think Novation, they packaged this with a number of different computers. So I've seen, I think I might have this actual thing, like the Cat Novation Cat branded one. But I've also got one that I think is Radio Shack branded. And I have one that's Apple branded. So this, you know, it's the same machine, but with different, you know, different labels on it. So it was popular for a little while back when 300 baud was a thing.
And it has an RS-232 port on it. So it's an acoustic coupler, vintage modem for Apple II, and everything else.
Right, right. Oh yeah, no, it was the description does say Apple II, I'm pretty sure I had one that came with a color computer a lot at some point, you know, so, I mean, like, I definitely have at least three of these that have different brandings on them, but otherwise the same inside. The Apple one was...
Not a ton of use anymore for modems, though.
No, they're just, there's something about the way the plastic is that just makes it always look dusty, too, like, no matter what you do.
That's true.
It's permadust.
Anyway. All right, I'm done. It was kind of fun, though. But
yeah.
So now we can move on to closing discussions. And Jack, you wrote something here. What did you almost do?
Yeah, I almost bought a thing. I was so close to buying this thing, this Atari portfolio, early 90s handheld PC thing, folding lid. Local auction here in Sweden. I was ready. I was pumped. And then, like, it was the last few minutes, and I got busy cooking something, and I just forgot about it.
Oh.
And it was totally a bummer because it went for what was a pretty good price for the thing plus the parallel port interface. Damn it. Oh, well.
Well, you just got to think that, like, if you had bid, the other person would have just bid it up to, like, a ton of money. So
that's possible.
Just believe that. It's easier.
Yeah, that is frustrating.
At least you would have made them pay for taking it from you.
Right.
That's right. They should have made them pay for
it.
That's
a mercenary way to think of it, but okay, Earl.
Yeah, I look at those every once in a while. And I have seen a couple that have, you know, a lot of times it's just like a single thing that's just beat up and, you know, doesn't seem all that appealing. You know, some piece is missing or whatever. Right. But occasionally I've seen ones that have, like, I think it's like a hard drive add-on and like you were saying, like the parallel port thing. And it, like, would be, I don't think I would want it except if it had, like, a bunch of those extra things that are unusual.
Right, because, like, the other add-ons, you can actually still buy them from, what's it called, from Best Electronics. They still sell, like, essentially new old stock of these parallel port interfaces, but then those cost, like, $45. They cost almost more than a used portfolio costs, so. Oh, well, one of these days.
At least it won't take up a lot of space.
That's true.
Let's see. No one else has put anything in the closing discussions. Carrington, do you have anything?
No, except I can't find my little USB to USB-C dongle thing. So I'm recording on an older computer. So I kind of went retro myself. Hey, computers with a bunch of ports. They're useful.
Yeah.
So why hung on to this?
Nice.
Old computers are better, man. Plus the keyboard on my current MacBook kind of sucks. I really don't like the current keyboards. But I type on it every day. Boom.
I'm still running, you know, a generation older with all the ports, you know, all the stuff sticking outside. But...
Mm. I've kept my 13-year-old one from the older generation. That's what I'm recording on right now, and I'm glad I did, so I could actually be part of the show. Somewhere in the house is a dongle.
Earl, you have any closing thoughts?
Well, speaking of being part of the show, our dear listeners would not know this, but the gang actually... dragged their feet for a few minutes. I was stuck in traffic, and I appreciate you guys waiting on me. It was fun to...
I voted against it.
as you should, but luckily democracy prevailed, and so thank you guys for waiting. It's fun as always.
Actually, Jack voted against it too, but Paul informed us it wasn't a democracy. The iron fist of Paul came down. No, I'm kidding.
Let's see. So, I just this morning posted the previous episode. Is that interesting? I don't know. So who knows when the listening public is hearing this, but hopefully this will be coming in pretty close to the end of the previous one. I got a, cool. a Mac Mini. That's probably my newest Mac thing.
I love the Mac Mini.
Because I was trying to run my video, enterprise on a old iMac that was really not up to the task. So I've got a Plex server and I moved it all over to the Mini. And I was just thinking about that.
That's exactly what I use. I use a Mac Mini as a Plex server right now. It's awesome. I got to change my drives over to get things that are, happier running 24/7 all the time. I haven't done like WD Red drives or whatever. I'm just testing it out, but everything's going to collapse if I don't do that. So I will move it over, but I'm happy with the setup. Plex on a Mac Mini works great.
Yeah, I think I'm still sort of, getting everything set up. I have an absurd number of hard drives connected to it, but you're mentioning the ports was kind of reminding me of that. I mean, like I've just got like, it's like this nice little neat box and then just like this rat's nest of cables all coming out the back.
But I just went with two giant drives that are mirroring each other. Just easier.
Oh yeah. I have five Drobo units connected to it.
Oh my goodness. Okay. And, wow.
And a couple of SSD, like little RAID drive things with two SSDs in them. Yeah, I have, as I say, an absurd number. There's probably 9, 10 hard drives connected to this thing.
Wow.
And like five of those are Drobos, which have like four or five in each. So I've been building this collection up for a long time, though. I mean, like I didn't just buy all this stuff. Video takes up a lot of space.
Cool.
As it turns out.
I just have two 8-terabyte drives. So like the one I'm using and the one is the backup and that's it.
Yeah, I'm the amount of data that I have now makes me really, it is, Backblaze, by the way, has unlimited backups. So I'm taking total advantage of that, but because, I'm not on their enterprise thing or whatever. I'm on the home personal thing and I've got, I think it's like 48 terabytes or something backed up with them.
See, most of my movies and stuff are ripped DVDs. So luckily they don't take a ton of space compared to like Blu-rays. And also luckily my eyesight's bad enough that works for me.
Well, my problem is that we relatively recently got a upgraded TV. So now it's actually got 1080, I'm several generations behind, I'm sure. But so now everything looks like junk. And so, now I want all the P,
Right. Yeah. My TV is still a 1080p as well. It's a 75-inch monster, but it's just a 1080p. And I run DVD stuff on it, and I'm like, looks fine. Look, it's slightly fuzzy, just like the whole world is to me.
Yes, that's true.
That'd be the true cost of getting LASIK. If I got that done and my eyes fixed, I'd have to upgrade my entire media library, and I just can't afford it.
Honestly, that's the thing that kept me from switching away from the 4x3 CRT for a long time. It's because as soon as I do that, all of this video I have is going to look like just junk. Okay, so that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And that will help us, if we do not prepare, to have something to say. We are a member of the Throwback Network. That's at a link in the show notes. And if you wish, you can write a review on iTunes. And until next time...
Retro Compute!